Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I recently spoke with Luke Roberts about his book, Performing the Great Peace, Political Space and Open Secrets in Tokugawa Japan, that came out with the University of Hawaii Press in 2012. This was such a pleasure to do for me as an interviewer. Roberts is extraordinarily thoughtful about his own role as a historian, about the basic categories that go into writing history and writing political history in particular. This is a book that will change the way you think about space. It'll change the way you think about political space and about what it is to read and work with documents to write a history. It's just an extraordinarily innovative history of early modernity. It's also quite engaging and very funny at times. And we had a really good time talking about it. So I hope you enjoy, and I hope you enjoy the book as well. It's a great book. Hi, Luke.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Luke Roberts about his book, Performing the Great Peace, Political Space and Open Secrets in Tokugawa Japan. And that came out with University of Hawaii Press in 2012. Now, Luke, I haven't yet said this to you, but I really loved reading this book. I learned a lot from it. It's a really wonderful book with, I think, very wide-ranging, important wide-ranging appeal for how we think about what it is to do and what it has looked like to do historiography, not just of early modern Japan or Tokugawa Japan, but historiography in general. So it was a really wonderful read, and thank you so much for talking with us about it today.
Well, thank you so much for your comments. My goal was to take up a small place, but to interpret it in a way that would have meaning for people who are interested in other regions as well.
I think that absolutely succeeded, and I hope that'll come out as we talk about this. I think this is a book that is really important, I think, not just for scholars of East Asian studies, but anyone who thinks about historical documents as a form of evidence for telling a story about the past. So, So Luke, can you start us off a little bit about just saying a little bit about how you got into this field and maybe specifically how you transitioned from the topic of your first book to this book that you just published?
Okay. Let's see. How did I get into this field?
I know it's a really broad question, but any way you want to answer it is great.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, when I was in college, I wanted to be an archaeologist of Mayan civilization.
Really?
And but while I was at college, I kind of learned I didn't really want to be an archaeologist. And I just started asking friends who were great professors. And I was at Oberlin College, and there was this one guy, Ron DiCenzo, who taught at Oberlin. Everybody said, oh, he's the greatest professor. And so I went and took his class, and he was indeed wonderful. And he taught both Japanese language and Japanese history. And that was my senior year of college. And he made me fascinated with Japan. So when I graduated, I went to Japan, got a job teaching English to people in factories and that kind of a thing. And while doing that, I became very interested in the history and decided, well, I want to become an historian. And while there, I ended up being 2 years a research student at Tokyo University. And while there, one professor, he was asking all of us, what do you want to research? And I said, I didn't really know what I wanted to research. I said, I'll research samurai. And he stood up and left the room because all of the students, they all wanted to do like village stuff, and this was the cool thing. And to study samurai was a bit strange in that context. He stood up and left the room. I wondered what I'd done. And he walks back with a stack of 10 manuscript volumes and put them down in front of me and said, read these.
Wow.
Next. And then he went on, and then the next person started saying, and so I looked at these things and I opened them up. And of course, it's just handwritten stuff. It looked like these worms all scrawled on the spit on a page. I thought, oh my goodness, what can I do? So after class, I asked him, he says, well, you know, just go up to the reference room of the archive, and there they have dictionaries that will help you. And I ended up spending a whole year learning how to read this, but it turned out actually to be a history written in the 1820s of Tosa domain and the retainer band, you know, all of the samurai of of that, written by one of its own retainers in the 1830s. And I invested a whole year into reading that. While doing so, I traveled to Tulsa or Kochi and met some wonderful people, and they were very, very helpful and friendly. And I had an extremely fine time there. And I, of course, learned that there's a tremendous wealth of documents down there. And so this is how I got interested into Tulsa, which really is sort of the starting point. What documents are there are the starting point for all of the research I've ever done since. And my first book, which emerged from my dissertation, was on political economy and especially political economic thought largely that created by merchants of Tulsa domain. And this, they had this idea of kokueki, or the domainal national prosperity, you know, the country prosperity of Tulsa domain. And while doing that, I felt that in order to understand how these people were thinking, I really had to depend upon their language and see Tulsa as a country, because this is the way they talked about it. And this was very strange to me, of course, at first, because I thought, well, Japan's the country, Tulsa is not the country. But I gradually, being based upon what they were saying, decided, well, that's the best way to interpret it. And so I wrote my first book describing Japan as this international order, Tokugawa era Japan as a kind of an international political economic order, sort of an empire, you know, with many small countries within it. And the domains as countries. I was very interested in the way people thought about government. What's the purpose of government? So I spent very close work with the language. And I discovered that a lot of the historiographic terminology that we use to talk about Tokugawa period Japan is really modern. And I was kind of surprised by that. I thought, even in English, we use so many Japanese words like the bakufu and the han and all of these things to describe Tokugawa period Japan. And yet it wasn't really in the documents. And that was, this may sound strange, but I felt betrayed. There was actually this very painful moment for me when I thought, my goodness, I've invested so much of my energy into learning how to see this world through these words and these terms, and yet that isn't the way that they saw it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of disturbing. And I didn't fully play out the implications of that in my first book, and that's one reason why I wrote this book, you know, the Performing the Great Peace, was so that I could further explore the implications of the fact that when we use the modern terminology to understand the pre-modern past, it changes things in very great ways. And so in writing this book, my goal was to use the language of the past itself about the politics and political behavior as sort of the primary way to organize my information, and then figure out how to translate that into present concerns and into modern, what I call nationalizing discourses of understanding. And it turned out to be extremely difficult. I was really surprised at what a difficult project this book was for me. But it was fun. I mean, I learned quite a lot, I think, in the process. Does that answer your question, Mo?
Absolutely. I mean, that's wonderful. And I think one of the things that's coming out of your description of how you got into this project in the first place is a really penetrating and really wonderful, for those of us also involved in history, degree of self-reflexivity about your process that's very much on the page in the book as well. I mean, I think you're mentioning the use of, is this Kuni, to translate
yes.
Country versus not, and the kind of the ways that responses to this move actually made you rethink or, you know, think in different ways about your own practice and how you think about these forms of space and how to translate these terms was really powerful as a practicing historian reading this. And it's really kind of wonderfully freeing, actually, to see that process on the page here.
Oh, that's good.
Just really great. Now, and you just brought up also one of the really fundamental parts, at least for me as a reader of this book, which is the sensitivity to the terminology of documents. And I think this is a wonderful place for us to get started right into the book itself. The book opens with this really, what starts out being this really wonderfully odd account of a death the Castle Diary of Tahara Domain, which relates an incident from 1792. And long story short, the document involves, in one paragraph, one death date for the same guy who died, and in another paragraph, a death date like 55 days earlier. And there doesn't seem to be any conflict for the writer of this document in this. And for the reader, this is completely shocking. And for you, you sort of mentioned being surprised by this. Can you talk a little bit about this case and sort of why this was so shocking and so important to you?
Yeah, it's
what's going on here, basically? Like, how do you have two different death dates in the same document written by the same author for the same guy?
Yeah, this was how shall I call it? A deathbed adoption ceremony for a daimyo. The way these ceremonies worked was because the Tokugawa law stated that a daimyo had to be alive, he had to be of sound mind when he named his heir, his adopted heir. And this is, of course, for daimyo who didn't have children, a male child at the time. They would have to name this. If the daimyo himself did not name his heir while alive, then the domain was forfeit and the daimyo's household was ended. And when this happened, of course, hundreds or thousands of retainers are out of work, and all of the people who have these deep economic relations with the daimyo's house, the townspeople and the farmers, also end up, frankly, getting hurt very badly by such an event. Nevertheless, the Tokugawa law is very strict on this, and so that they send in the chief grand inspector of the whole Tokugawa government, along with a whole bevy of doctors who go there to certify that this person is indeed alive and all of that. And they go through the ceremony that this daimyo would indeed impress his seal down on this document saying, I want so-and-so to be my heir. One document records this very severe ceremony in great detail, and everything seems to go fine. Now, the document which I introduce in the book is a recording of that first event, so to speak, that ceremony. But it also, this is part of a letter that's sent way back to the home domain, far away from Edo. And the very next paragraph in that letter says, well, as all of you back home know, the Lord really died about 55 days earlier. But we couldn't tell everybody about this until the adoption ceremony was done. It was very, like the first paragraph even had this phrase that everybody was in tears and speechless with grief. And it's described with such verisimilitude. It's really something that I was just quite shocked how in this one letter, just from one paragraph to another, the worlds, the whole universes of your realities had changed. And trying to figure out how people could be comfortable with that and why that was meaningful to them. Was in a sense a challenge that that this book, in a sense, was set to answer.
That's great. And there's a whole chapter on this that we'll get to, on these wonderful, I don't know about wonderful, but these very kind of shocking deathbed adoptions and all of the machinations and performances that go into making this make sense. Now, this account sort of opens what's going to be a book-length discussion, a discussion that sort of recurs throughout the whole book, on the importance of the performance of authority to the performance of authority in Tokugawa politics. Now, you're arguing here that because the logic by which certain Tokugawa institutions operated has been understudied and underappreciated, we really don't understand, or we've significantly misunderstood, the functioning and the nature of the documents that have led us to, or that were produced by this system and that have led us to understand this system. Can you say a bit about that?
Yes. Yeah. So, for example, with regard to this deathbed adoption ceremony or the two different death dates, in terms of the Tokugawa clan, the shogunal house, the documents that would survive in their records need to portray the what you might call the ritual reality of things. And in order to maintain the authority of the Tokugawa, they need only they must acknowledge only what you might call what should happen or the official happenings of things. And conversely, what this means is that what really happens in a sense, say in the sense of this daimyo's death, cannot be recorded in Tokugawa documents. And so if you're an historian and you only depend upon documents that formal documents that come through the Tokugawa house, you won't know much about what really went on. And this is a hierarchical order, so that the daimyo, who in this relationship is inferior to the Tokugawa, will contain a lot of documents that in their own archives that do relate to what we might say really went on in this event, when the Lord really died and so on. And viewed from the daimyo, what the Tokugawa is an omote. And the Japanese term omote is sort of a ritual interface, a sort of a site of ritual interaction where everybody performs the fact that the superior has all of the authority and the inferior party is indeed nothing but a servant. And the daimyo's space is this uchi or naibun, a sort of an inside space, a portion of his own competence that in a sense is as long as the daimyo performs subservience to the Tokugawa and omote, what goes on in the daimyo's own inside space is opaque to the Tokugawa eye. And the Tokugawa don't look inside that internal space, and they don't really want to know what's going on, at least formally. Formally, they would never acknowledge these discrepancies, for example. And it's not as if, to get back to this adoption ceremony, it's not as if the Tokugawa officials didn't know what was going on. Everybody knew. And it's not true secrecy, but it's a matter of formalized knowledge or formalized understandings. And this is why, of course, the subtitle of the book is Political Space and Open Secrets. Okay. Subtitle is trying to get at this phenomenon that is really fundamental to the tenor and activity of most politics in the Tokugawa period.
That's great. And this is, you mentioned two things that are actually, that also go on to be absolutely central to every part of the book, at least on my reading of it, the importance of space and of terminology. I mean, I think one of the things that I really got out of this is that the omote and uchi, right? Mm-hmm. And for listeners, these concepts of omote and uchi and naisho,
yes,
right, go on to be, these are central to the argument of the book. But this gets at the point that, as I read it, there's no one political space in Tokugawa politics and Tokugawa documents. And there are multiple modes of space that each require and involve a certain kind of performance of political authority, and they're not conflicting necessarily. They just produce different versions of what really happened that each satisfy a different kind of need of this multi-layered overlapping spatial political structure of the Tokugawa.
Yes.
So it really sort of complicates the question of what really happened, right?
Yes,
because
yes.
What really happened is the guy both died, after this deathbed confession in omote space, and he also died 55 days earlier in this other inner space, right?
Yes.
So it sort of really kind of throws wide open and I think invites us to completely rethink what is historical truth and how we access that in the documents that we're working with.
Yes, indeed. And then there are layers beneath the daimyo authority, because the daimyo himself is an omote to his own retainers or to his own villagers and commoners. And so that the stories that exist at the daimyo omote are not the truth per se, but they're merely the daimyo omote truth. And then there would be different stories, so to speak, or different truths lower down in the hierarchy as well. So it's just layers and layers of these stories, in a sense.
And it's a kind of you mentioned the importance of open secrets, and this is the subtitle, and it's in a way, I think one of the things that, as at least I read that you're arguing here, is it's a certain kind of cultivation of a certain kind of disobedience that actually allows political order to be maintained, right? I mean, it's sort of built into the system, in this multi-spatial layered system. So terminology, also, we sort of, as we move into the book, terminology is extraordinarily important. And you've already mentioned how important thinking about terminology and the use of terminology, both by modern contemporary historians and also in documents, was central for bringing you into this topic in the first place. In terms of thinking about craft, you talk very explicitly in the introduction about your own decisions to translate certain terms and to leave certain terms untranslated and transliterated. Because this is such an important part of the historian's craft, can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's the most difficult part of the job. And that, because on the one hand, because I mean, at a fundamental level, and this is not merely just changing words, but in terms of describing what happens before them, I mean, the fundamental process of being an historian is as a translator, in a sense, is taking something that you can understand, that you've learned from the past, and then reshaping and refitting it so that people today and 2012 can understand it and hopefully enjoy it. And this is the fundamental nature of the process. And so to the degree possible, I want to turn everything into, say, English and into things that are easy to understand for people of the present, and to make it as clear and as possible, for this moment of people reading. It's a translation is in a sense a dialogue, and so that you have to address quite explicitly and openly the point of your respect for the voices that you learned from that are back there, and so because of that problem, I would say I muddled through. I would choose some words that I decided were so central, such as omote and uchi, and then naisho, which is sort of this informal negotiation that ties together the omote ritual interface and then the uchi, the inside portions of competence. Those words were so important that I usually used them in Japanese, and so I asked my readers to kind of learn them. There were a number of other words which I would translate for the most part, but I would sometimes, from time to time, use a Japanese term because I want to remind the reader that a translation is never perfect. It only captures some aspect of a word. And precisely because a translation can only translate an aspect of the word, I'm rather against making what you might call official lists of this is how you translate this term into English and this is how you translate that term into English and let's all agree on it. And sometimes we see these kind of movements, happening within our historical field. But I think there's a problem there because that doesn't address the issue of the multiple meanings that the words have. And they really only overlap in a kind of Venn diagram kind of way. There isn't a one-to-one parity to the words. And you really have to respect the context of utterance in order to truly understand the word. And one of the contexts is the imagined space within which the word takes on meaning. And this, of course, is a key issue in the whole book, that in modern historiography, we try to make all words understandable within an imagined space of the nation, in this case, Japan. And so that the words have to take on meaning. As soon as you utter it, the listener assumes, oh, this is the Japanese whatever, whatever it is you're talking about. But in the Tokugawa period, a tremendous number of words did not take on meaning within the space of Japan, but they took their meaning within a kind of an imagined space of one of these naibun or inside Uchi political spaces. And without recognizing that, you misunderstand a tremendous amount of what's happening in the Tokugawa period, I think.
That's great. And the whole, I think the last chapter and the conclusion really get into in depth these issues of the kind of the space of the nation or the imagined space of the nation being a context in which historiography, even Japanese historiography, kind of rewrote the meanings of these terms and read them back into Tokugawa text in way, or Tokugawa history in ways that you're, I think, very convincingly demonstrating here don't give us a full picture of the way political authority was actually constructed here. So talking about space, as we move into the book, I think the first chapter, The Geography of Politics, introduces us to layers of space and levels of space that are all going to go on to become important for the later parts of the story later on in the book. And these are geography, sort of geographical space, the space of the house, the space of occupational status as well. Now, there are so many things in this chapter that are fascinating, but one of the things that particularly stood out to me is the importance of the space of the household and its relationship to the performance of political subservience and political authority. And as we'll see, the household will go on to be really important also when we see sort of later case studies. Can you talk for a bit about, within this context, the importance of the space of the household as a space for the negotiation of political relationships? And I'm thinking in particular of the example, you give us the example of a samurai wife, Fukuoka Sho,
who kills
some guy for being rude to her, right? And there's this whole...
Dance
about whether she was justified or not and who's responsible. And so it's that kind of thing I'm thinking about that's actually really striking.
So actually the physical architectural house then in a sense.
The physical architectural space of the house.
So houses at this time were divided into front portions would have a portion called the omote, which of course is this very same term that's very key to Tokugawa politics. And this is the part of house into which it would have formal interactions with guests and outsiders. And there usually were a lot of restrictions about anybody moving beyond the omote into the back of the house, the oku portion of the house. And even the Grand Tokugawa Palace, you know, this enormous building with hundreds and hundreds of rooms, was also divided into its omote and oku. And moderately wealthy commoner even would have houses divided in the omote and oku. And so this incident with Fukuoka Sho, she killed a man who was of much lower status. He was like a foot soldier, so not really full rank samurai, whereas she herself was a samurai. And her husband, who was, of course, the retainer samurai, he was away way off in Edo, and she was back in the hometown of Kochi. And she killed him because she said he was rude to her. And it was legal in this world for samurai to execute people of lower status if they were deliberately rude. And so on that ground, she had the right to kill him. And indeed, when she's finally punished, the domain explicitly states that she had every right to kill him because he was rude. Nevertheless, she's punished because she had let this man into the back of the house. This didn't happen in the omote, but because she had let him back into the back of the house, that she herself had committed a grave fault. And so, and not merely did the punishment go to her, but then all of the men servants of the residents were punished because it was their duty to prevent any outsider from going to the back of the house. And even her husband, way off in Edo, because he officially is the head of the household, was punished. Because he's supposed to be responsible for making sure all members of his household behave appropriately. So the household itself is a legal unit, as well as an architectural unit, so to speak, an architectural thing. And these two things are very highly interrelated or closely tied together. So this whole notion of the importance of uchi and omote is imbued in daily life all the time. It's not just something that happens at moments of politicking, so to speak, but it really structures daily social relations, and therefore they become very meaningful and deep, I think, in terms of political interaction.
That was a really, that example in particular for me, just because I love the idea that she could kill some guy for being rude to her, but even, you know, this example, I think, really does a great job early in the book of bringing home the fact that these relationships of uchi and omote are not just, you know, sort of operative, as you just said, in official documents that have something to do with the court, but that are very much part of the mundane life of people who are living under Tokugawa society. Now, another thing that comes up in this chapter that also can is very strikingly important later on as well is the importance of naming practices as ways of performing a kind of political space. Can you say a little bit about that?
Once what you might call subjective identity changes depending upon what space one is kind of moving in or living in and operating in. And this is evident in the use of names. And so that especially elite Japanese such as daimyo have tremendous number of names. And each name is kind of operative in a certain space, at a certain omote situation of relations. And so the, for example, the ruler of Tosa domain, when he's facing the imperial omote, or you know, the kind of ritual space of ritual interaction with the imperial clan, he is a Fujiwara name. And he has to have this aristocratic name in order to even be able to interact with the imperial clan. And so this is one name that he has, and he doesn't use the Yamauchi name, which is the name by which we modern historians know the clan. Also, vis-a-vis the Tokugawa tried to incorporate a lot of daimyo into their own household by giving them the Matsudaira name, which is it's an early version of the Tokugawa name, is what it was, or earlier manifestation, early name for the Tokugawa clan. And so that they gave the Yamauchi daimyo the Matsudaira name, as they did, of course, to many, many other daimyo. And from that point, whenever the Yamauchi send a message to the Tokugawa, they can't use the Yamauchi name. They have to use their Matsudaira name to do that. And yet, in their inner space, in their own side space, they always use just the Yamauchi name. The daimyo themselves do this to their retainers. Many of the retainers have their own family names, but once they're granted the daimyo, say, Yamauchi name, then they have to use that vis-a-vis the daimyo. But in their own houses, they use their own names. So this is one aspect of naming helps us reveal what you might call the various political spaces or the various omote. Another aspect of naming is reflects to a person's power and gender. So that women, especially, at a higher omote, they can only be known as the wife of some man or the daughter of some man, and their own names just cannot be used. And this is in a way indicating that women don't really have an omote identity, but they're rather completely subsumed within an uchi space. An inside space. And indeed, a lot of the words that even today that we use to talk about women, such as kanai, which literally means inside the house, or okusan, the person of the back of the house, in the Edo period, we don't use it today so much, but another word is naisho-sama. In the Edo period, naisho literally means the person who kind of controls the inside. These are all words for women. Reflect the fact that it's very difficult for women to have a higher omote identity. Heirs, for men, if you become a direct heir of somebody who has an emolte, then suddenly you're allowed to, your own personal name can be your formal use name. And then even personal names, people have formal use names and then informal use names. You can use your formal use name at a higher emolte, but all of the younger brothers would have to use either informal use names, showing their lower status, or just be identified as son, for example, in extreme situations. Commoners could not have family names at all. Mm-hmm. In higher omote, many people misinterpret this, that a lot of times when you hear about Japan, you say, well, yeah, most commoners didn't have family names, and they only got them in the Meiji period. Mm-hmm. That isn't really true. What that really means is that commoners weren't allowed to use their family names in documents presented higher up to a higher omote. And many of them, if they were families of, you know, of wealth, kind of, they had their own identity that they would last generations as a household, they would have family names for inside use, but not for use at higher up. So these, I think, are some of the issues associated with naming and the importance of this compartment and political space that ruled the Tokugawa order.
That's great. Thank you. And speaking of misunderstandings, this actually kind of brings us into really an interesting aspect of the next chapter. So the next chapter looks at the information regime of the Tokugawa government, and in particular looks at the nature of information collection in terms of both accuracy, sort of judgments of accuracy, but also in its role in guaranteeing the kind of subservience of the daimyo and the maintenance of peace. So what you do here is you give us examples of touring inspections by Tokugawa officials and other means of gathering information that were used as part of this kind of system of control. Now, the daimyo, you said, often supplied inaccurate information, but with the full complicity of Tokugawa officials from very early on in the period. And the reason why I preface this by saying misunderstanding is that you tell us here that though some or many historians have interpreted this as a sign of, or have interpreted the sort of supplying by the daimyo to the Tokugawa political authorities of inaccurate information as a sign of decline of power and authority of the Tokugawa state. And in fact, you show here, this was actually happening very early on. And not only was it happening early on, but it was kind of an institutionalized part of the whole structure and kind of part of the system of open secrets and this relationship between the omote and uchi. So can you say a little bit about that for us? The sort of the fact that this is not a sign of systematic decline, and in what ways were was this important to the maintenance of authority?
Yes, that's naturally many, many more documents survived from the 18th century and the 19th century and the latter half of the Tokugawa period, and so many scholars see in these time periods where the documents survive in much greater numbers all of this evidence that the, for example, the daimyo are not being honest with the Tokugawa when they send up reports. And because documents from the 17th century are so much fewer by comparison, a lot of scholars, I think, perhaps quite naturally assumed that this is a sign of declining Tokugawa authority. And so I wanted to kind of test this by looking as deeply as I could into 17th century documents, and indeed some right from the very start, you know, from as early as 1605 or whatever, to see how information was managed. And what I think I discovered is that right from the very start, there's a lot of prevarication or not full disclosure going on in information submitted to the Tokugawa, despite the fact that there are indeed many documents, especially Tokugawa omote documents, which says you are going to tell me everything, and you cannot do this, you cannot do that, and you'll be completely accurate. And if an historian were just to read the Tokugawa omote documents, it looks like a really fearsome autocratic, very powerful regime. But when one can find uchi documents or documents surviving on the daimyo side, looking at the process of information production and sharing, you find not only that a lot of the information is not accurate, but that there's a tremendous amount of negotiation with Tokugawa officials over what they can say, over what they ought to say. This Naisho, this informal negotiation, and records of these generally only survive in the daimyo documents, and they obviously don't survive in the Tokugawa side, because the Tokugawa side is very invested in this performance of its authority and its power. And so that if somebody on the higher end, on the Tokugawa end, started joking around how they knew that they were being lied to, they themselves would be punished. And obviously the people that they were relating to would be punished, because this would really sully the dignity of the regime and the power of the regime. And so this is sort of, because of that fact, you have to use Tokugawa documents with great care and perhaps suspicion, as to what the content really reflects. I mean, if one were not to regard it with suspicion, the way one should regard it is, yes, this is the ritual truth. This is what the Tokugawa wanted to hear, and this is what they want to portray. That's really the most natural way to read Tokugawa documents. And one of my favorite documents from this section was dealing with the touring inspectors of Tosa Domain. And so they have the Tokugawa touring inspectors, and they travel through all of the domains of Japan, and their job is to make sure that government is good and everything is going right. And they themselves are told that they aren't supposed to have many interactions with the local samurai, but they're really just there to talk to the people. And we can find documents on the Tosa side all promising, oh, yes, of course, we will have no interactions with you and we won't do anything. And the officials on the Tokugawa side say, oh, yes, we'll follow our orders very carefully. But you look at the way it really happens, and it's nothing of the sort. I don't think they ever really talked to a single commoner the whole time. And one little document is my favorite, was that although the touring inspectors are supposed to plan their own route and stay and where they stay and all of that, in reality, the Tosa officials select all of the houses, and they'll select really lovely places like the daimyo's traveling residence or samurai homes or things like that. And there's this cute little marks beside each of these residences will say this is a village headman's house, or say this is a merchant's house, or whatever. And it helps you imagine what's going on. And it's not as if the touring inspectors, however stupid they might be, could not recognize a daimyo's traveling residence for a village headman's house. You know, they would know the difference immediately, but they would play along. And I'm sure in their interactions, you know, they would say something like, oh, what a lovely home your village headsman has.
That was great. One of the things that was also wonderful about these cases that you show us here of the touring inspectors is this sort of the importance of, I think, really interestingly for me, the importance of precedent. And so it seemed like in trying to figure out how far local officials could actually push these rules, sort of how much could they prepare, how much could they bend, they were sort of looking to what was happening in neighboring regions, right? So for example, Is it okay if we serve them sake? And another guy's like, well, it's okay, but over there, you know, you could serve them, but you can't drink it yourself. So we can serve them, but we can't drink it themselves. You know? So it's, I love that.
And it's thanks to that that we have so many records of this behavior. And if it weren't for that they were constantly wanting to check for precedents and learn what their neighbors are doing and all of that, a lot of this would have disappeared from history, so to speak.
It's fascinating. It's sort of this sort of codification of kind of neighborly gossip, almost. I mean, a more official or a more kind of a better version of that. But it was just it's very exciting to read accounts of documents like this. So now this sort of because I don't want to keep you for 3 hours, which would easily get you for this book. I'll just say for our listeners, the next chapter is it's called Politics of the Living Dead, and it focuses on these deathbed adoptions. And I'm not going to actually ask you any more about this, but I will just say for our listeners, wonderful, wonderful stuff in here. All kinds of just fantastic stories, and I loved this chapter.
Oh, great.
We could talk for hours about that. But what I want to ask you about, I want to make sure to talk about, is something that happens in the next chapter, territorial border disputes. Now, in this chapter, you're looking at the operation of the Tokugawa legal system in the resolution of territorial disputes, both between villages and between daimyo. And so this plays out, you look at two cases of conflicts between daimyo over territorial boundaries on two small islands, and then in the case of a shrine or temple complex. But there's another case that you raise, and this is what I want to ask you about, which is a case of villagers using the politics of omote and naisho to defeat their own daimyo in Tokugawa.
Yes, yes.
Now, could you explain a little bit about this case? Because it involves two things that absolutely, I was almost laughing out loud when I read this. And this is palanquin suits and barging in suits. Okay, so first, could you tell us about this particular case of these villagers kind of manipulating these politics? And can you also, as part of this, perhaps explain what are palanquin suits and what are barging in suits and why are they so fantastic?
Okay. This case was, there were two villages within the Tahara domain of the Daimyo Miyake clan, and they were having a border dispute over controlling some land that sort of existed between them. And one of them wanted to develop this land, and the other village wanted to keep the land for fertilizer and for firewood and for pine needles, which, interestingly enough, was a valuable product at the time. One of the villages was not satisfied with the daimyo's, the domain's decision on this. And so then they decided they would appeal to the Tokugawa government high court. Now, this was illegal. There really is no formally acceptable way for commoners within a daimyo's realm to appeal to the Tokugawa government. And the laws are very clear on this. Nevertheless, this kind of thing happened all the time. And the Tokugawa government is flooded with requests, appeals by villagers who live solely within daimyo domains. And there develops this illegal system of appeal and judgment in the Tokugawa period that's tremendously important, of course, to throughout the whole realm. And this depends upon certain kinds of activities of the commoners, including these palanquin suits and the barging in suits. And what a palanquin suit is the commoners from some daimyo domain will approach the palanquin of some high court official of the Tokugawa government, and they have to run and get the suit, which they've written down. Ideally, it has to be able to touch the body, the person of the high official. And if it touches him, then he has to, in a sense, read it and accept it. And the reality is, as many times that they would run up and one of the guards would grab it, but the guard would still hand it over to the official, and the official would read this. But because this is illegal, immediately the person who presented the suit would be bound up. They would tie him up with rope, which was a very degrading sign, so to speak. It's like, you know, putting one in handcuffs or whatever. And then they often would be sent to the residents of the daimyo, his realm of whom they were at, and told to await a word. And then the higher officials would read it, and then they'd decide what to do. Sometimes they would, most often, frankly, they would say, "We don't want to hear it," and they'd send it back. But usually, at least that's the official message. Probably what really happened is that they would send an official message saying, "We don't want to hear this case." But the messenger would probably consult with domain officials and say, can't you do something about this? Your people are so upset that they're coming all the way to Edo to make this appeal. And then the daimyo's government himself, of course, might have to reconsider what they're doing. But because the this kind of a suit presented either to a palanquin, another, you asked about the barging in suit, another thing which commoners might do is just they would barge into the residence of some high Tokugawa official and again present their appeal there. And again, they'd be tied up and sent back. The Tokugawa law for this is it's a death penalty for such a thing. And so that the people go knowing that the formal law says that to engage in this kind of activity is will cost you your life. But if you actually look at how these things happen, and for example, the case that I look at, they must have done it 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 times, just an incredible number of tremendous persistence, constantly presenting and representing and representing their appeals to the government officials. And it really was their persistence that finally made the Tokugawa officials come in, still informally, and muscle around the daimyo and say, listen, you're going to change this appeal. But because the local, for some reason, I don't quite know why, the Miyake daimyo at this time was very reluctant to change its judgment. And this irritated the Tokugawa quite well. There was even discussion about whether they would disenfief the Miyake because of this, because they'd failed to manage, they'd failed to maintain the peace, in a sense, and failed to manage this problem internally. And so this was a much more extreme example of this kind of activity than usually happens. Usually it resolves much more peacefully and, frankly, without anybody dying. But in this case, the domain itself did execute the one or two, I actually forget, but at least one of the leaders of this, I think because the whole event was so painful to the daimyo's dignity and all of that. And a number of commoners were banished from the domain as a result of this. The punishments were quite severe, but the villagers won. An interesting thing about Tokugawa law is that villagers usually win, and it's usually a painful process. It costs a lot of money and time and jail time for many people, and on extreme cases, it might even involve terrible physical punishment and execution on behalf of one person on behalf of the village. But the judgment very often ends up respecting the villagers' wishes. Now, in terms of this book, to me, the most interesting thing is that all of this activity, which is formally illegal, very clearly should not be done in the Tokugawa law, is systematized, and everybody accepts it or acknowledges it informally. They don't carry out things according to the way the formal law should be, and they're constantly trying to suppress disorder, and the daimyo themselves are responsible for any disorder that kind of pops out of their domain. So that this order not only gives the daimyo power, but it also, they're hostages to this great peace as well. Mm-hmm. And the villagers know how to use this situation. And I don't mean to make this sound beautiful or anything, because it indeed is a very oppressive system and all. But nevertheless, this is how politics happened. And one can see how it does give people in very low positions certain forms of power, what kinds of power they have. And therefore, you can analyze and understand their political activity by understanding the system.
Now, another source of political power that you raise here, and this is in the next chapter, which was really interesting and surprising. What you talk about, what we might conventionally think of as religious institutions, right? Particularly Buddhism, to some extent, Christianity is kind of a contrast case, and then Shinto. And you're really showing here how sort of transformations in the way these entities and these sort of religious, we can call them, I'm using scare quotes for listeners who can't see, sort of religious entities are treated from Tokugawa and all the way through into Meiji. how these transformations actually sort of represent transformations in the larger political structure as well. I know we don't have too much time, but because it's so important here, can you talk a little bit about the importance of Buddhism as a dominant religious form in the Tokugawa and sort of why it was so important and why it was so dominant?
Yeah. Well, it was absolutely the wealthiest of all of these religious organizations and institutions and things. And it becomes important it becomes absolutely dominant. I mean, it was important from the very start of the Tokugawa period. This is actually, I feel like it's very hard to answer this question, but
I know it's hugely broad. I'm trying to get at the I mean, I'll be more specific. I'm sorry, I was so broad. You emphasize here the importance of Buddhism as it's an entity that's got an emphasis on combination. And so this is a religious structure that doesn't gain authority through exclusion, but rather through combination, and how this really this differed from Christianity. And one of the reasons why Christianity had such a problem getting a foothold in the Tokugawa authorities was not necessarily just the ideas, but that it was about exclusion of other religious ideas, and that didn't cohere with this larger political structure of the Tokugawa. So having said that, maybe sort of in the time we have, this as Shinto... So where does Shinto fit in here?
I think politically, Shinto is very much a kind of a junior partner. I mean, this kami worship and all, and this worship of these deities as kami generally exists within the fold of Buddhist institutions, and because Buddhism has this combinatory kind of drive where it kind of incorporates difference. And says, well, this is a new manifestation of something that we've already been saying, sort of, what you might call is kind of like the knee-jerk approach to encountering difference, rather than saying, oh, this is the devil, or this is, something that we need to exclude. The Shinto and the kami deities are very, very closely related to imperial history and to local history within Japan. And it's one of the ways by which people, in a sense, created history through ritual, was by deifying this mountain or this individual this kind of a thing. And I think as literacy expanded in the Tokugawa period, which it did greatly, and people are starting writing lots and lots of stories and reading lots and lots of stories and kind of crafting this imagined entity of Japan, a lot of the narratives are in terms of deities, and increasingly you see that they start doing their best to tie these deities to the old imperial histories of, say, the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki and all of this, and trying to relate whatever deity happened to be local to the imperial story. This becomes one of the ways by which people start imagining a Japan as a land of the kami, a land of these kind of Shinto deities. And the daimyo get in on it too. And so as more and more people like to understand the world in terms of this shrine worship and these kami deities and this kind of a thing, the daimyos increasingly start deifying the ancestors of the founding ancestor of the daimyo house. And they start developing, in some cases, not in all cases, because each of these daimyo realms are really quite different, but in some daimyo realms, they start developing things that have a lot of the element of state Shinto. To my mind, the most fascinating thing about it is a lot of it is rather than being hierarchical or status-based, it's more kind of an equality of subjecthood where everybody equally should be devoted to this deity, which more models, I think, the early 20th century forms of Shinto spirituality in Japan. And so I like to see it actually as a kind of a precursor or a resource which Meiji people then used. in creating their own state Shinto. Now, in terms of this book, the most interesting thing is that all of this was illegal. The Tokugawa say again and again, you may not deify your ancestors, and you may not make new shrines, you may not make new festivals, you may not make new temples for that matter. And yet, all of these do it. And in serious cases, is even people who are serving as the temple shrine magistrate in the Tokugawa government, who are constantly telling other daimyo, you may not create a new deity or a new temple, are in their own domains creating deities out of their ancestors and new festivals and all of that. And I think from a modern perspective, it looks ridiculous. But again, you know, within this political order, it made a lot of sense to them. And it was a way to kind of keep it, contain the potential for disorder of this, these kind of newer forms of worship from upsetting Tokugawa authority and the Tokugawa regime.
Great. Well, Luke, we've taken up a ton of your time. So I won't ask you about this final chapter about history and historians, but I will say on the record for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read this book, every historian should read this chapter. This is a chapter that looks at the way that these concerns about Uche and Omote play out in the space of Tokugawa historiography, looks at various levels of and sort of various ways that the history of the Tokugawa was refracted at different political levels, and sort of speaks, I think, very elegantly, very eloquently, and very openly about the ways that historiography has shaped what we know about this, and also that the way we understand documents of the Tokugawa, both the Omote documents and the other documents, have shaped what we can know about this and what we have known. And there's this just wonderful example here of a historian, Watanabe Hiroshi, you mentioned, his decision to actually rewrite chapters of his book because he decided that he had gotten it wrong. And he changed the way he understood the way some of these concepts worked. And I think that's just wonderful example of, again, this kind of self-reflexivity. And
really, yeah, his book was a great inspiration to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Every, I'll just sort of mention that as this chapter particularly spoke to me in terms of its the way you handled the craft of history and the way the craft of history has played out in this case. So, Luke, there's a ton in this book that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about, and there's so much more in here that we could talk about. Is there any part of the book that we haven't yet had a chance to go into that you would like to make sure that you mention for the benefit of listeners, either those who have read the book or those who haven't yet had the chance to read the book?
No, I guess one thing perhaps is in the conclusion. I talk a lot about the difference between the Tokugawa terminology and understandings and the modern understandings. And one thing I find that when I talk about, for example, the importance of Omote and Naisho in the Tokugawa period, very many Japanese scholars will immediately respond to me, Omote and Ura. And Ura means the backside or the hidden part of things. And today, people in this kind of unitary space of Japan, or there's also tatemae and honne is another dichotomy that people use to talk about modern Japan a lot. These imply that one is true and the other is somehow false or slightly corrupt or not quite true. And that reflects, I think, a very modern perspective on this issue. But in the Edo period, these what you might call these situational truths of Omote truth and Naiben truth, in that time period, they didn't regard one as false and the other as true, but they're rather situationally true. And I think it's very important for modern readers to understand this at a deep level as you're reading my book or, you know, this book and thinking about the evidence of the Tokugawa period is how much attitudes towards this kind of activity has changed. It sort of exists today, but it's no longer an ideal form of politics. Today, it's kind of slightly corrupt, so to speak.
And that's another thing I think that this your book invites us to think about, which I haven't had a chance to ask you, but I'll just put out there, is sort of to what extent that these phenomena that you are talking about here in the context of Tokugawa politics might translate into other early modern contexts and might help those of us working with other kinds of documents. So actually, what do you, what's your take on that? I mean, how transferable do you think these insights are to other early modern contexts?
Yeah, it's, I think there's great potential for it, because the importance of ritual, when I think of China, of course, you know, and the way the Confucian scholars talk about government and all, and how, what a great importance they put upon the use of ritual for good government and that kind of a thing. I think there's a tremendous, potentially a tremendous similarity between the way they, you know, the rituals would operate and the omote, which is essentially kind of rituals of subservience. And in early modern medieval Europe, I've read a number of books where I saw a lot of things that felt very similar to me in the importance of maintaining dignity and honor and face as part of politics. So I think there are places where there's kind of a harmony or, you know, an ability to extend, fruitfully kind of put these situations into dialogue.
I completely agree. 1,000% I agree with you. So what's next for you, Luke? What are you working on now? And what's inspiring you at the moment? What project?
I'm working on a biography of a samurai, a guy named Mori Yoshiki, who was a samurai of Tosa domain, again, who lived from about 1760 to about 1805 or so. And he has this incredibly well-recorded life. His father kept a diary, he's a really great diary. So I see my man from the moment he's born and even earlier, you know, like when his sisters are born and stuff like this. And he kept a couple diaries, about three of his friends kept diaries. His son kept a diary and also wrote my man's, his father's biography. And he asked the chief manservant of my man to write stories about his death, which is of course my man. So I have this life that's really, really richly recorded from many different perspectives. One of the coolest things this guy did, the son, his father died when, my man died when the son was only about 4 or 5 years old. So he didn't really personally know his father all that well. He learned his father through his diary, actually. Wow. And about 15 years later, after his father's death, he invited all of his father's old friends to a party. And he read them sections of his father's diary. And he said, "This is all I know of my dad. Tell me more." And so each of them told him stories and he wrote them all down. It was such a wonderful document. So what I'm doing now is doing a biography, but kind of as a form of social history. I'm really interested in all of his kind of networks of interaction and his ties with the people around him and how people would talk about things and look at each other, the way they would kind of regard each other and write about each other. So, and through this, I hope to be able to get a really nice kind of a thick picture of the life of a samurai. I'm probably just going to call this book a Samurai's Life. And so it's kind of a different type of project I'm into.
That's wonderful. That sounds totally fascinating. And it also, it sounds like just the kind of sensitivity to sort of multiple overlapping, multi-layered versions of truth about a kind of historical event or historical actor that's so richly, that you give to us so richly here. So good luck with that and be
Thank
in
you.
Touch when that's done and we'll talk about that one for New Books in East Asian Studies.
Hopefully it won't take me as long as this one did.
Well, thank you so much, Luke. Thanks for taking the time. It's, as I've already said, it's a wonderful book, and I hope all of the listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it go out and read the book, and I think it's also a very important book, so thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm really grateful.
My pleasure. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.